The Process, a podcast about creativity and experimental music. In the world of experimental music, outcomes and accolades for creators can be uncertain and at times seem far and few between. Therefore, creators and practitioners of experimental music must embrace the one thing they will always have complete control over, the process. This podcast aims to understand this creative process by listening to new works and discussing them with their creators. Each episode focuses on one creator and their music. Understanding how and why they create can inform aspiring creatives and help audiences better understand and navigate experimental music. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and I'll be your host as we explore the world of experimental music, creativity, and the human need to find purpose in their world and lives. This is The Process. And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. This is a quote from John Steinbeck in his novel, East of Eden. You may know John Steinbeck as a famous American writer of books like Grapes of Wrath, which chronicled the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, as well as Of Mice and Men and Lenny and the Rabbits and Curly's Wife and all the other interesting characters in that book. And I really love this quote, "And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good." I spoke with Stephanie Lamprea in today's episode, and we're about to learn a lot about her as a performer, specifically as a hero of new music and also an advocate for vocal music. Stephanie and I talked about perfection and also perfection and what that means in the conservatory model. And we talked a little bit about the restrictions and the whole idea of conservatories, which I think lately have fallen under a little bit of scrutiny, especially with the eyes of somebody from 2021, thinking about the definition of a conservatory, which is to conserve tradition, and how problematic that can be from our 2021 perspective. Stephanie also said something really beautiful about finding her own voice and finding that the conservatory model and the teachers that she had, though they were fantastic, were giving her advice about what she could do and what she couldn't do with her voice. And at the end of the day, it's her voice, right? And I can sympathize with that with composition. I think for any creative listening to the program, if you've ever had a teacher, at some point they've told you the rules, told you things you can do and you can't do. And I think that, especially for a young creative, that can be very restrictive. I think it can create a scenario where you don't feel comfortable writing what you want to write. And then you get locked into this idea of whatever you do, because it's maybe such an affront to the establishment or to the rules, and it has to be perfect. But I love John Steinbeck in his first novel, East of Eden. He points out that now that you don't have to be perfect, you could be good. And I think Stephanie articulates this. You know, Stephanie is clearly a virtuosic performer, especially in new music with all the extended technique and all the vocal rigor of that. So is Stephanie perfect? Well, who cares? It's good. Speaking of good, let's take a listen to Stephanie performing Eddie Kamsuzu's Love's Witness, and then learn a little bit more about Stephanie and hear her opinions on performing, collaborating with composers, and about being perfect.
Premeditated. Meditated.
Colombian-American soprano Stephanie Lampra is an architect of new sounds and expressions as a performer, recitalist, curator, and improviser, specializing in contemporary classical repertoire. Trained as an operatic coloratura, Stephanie uses her voice as a mechanism of avant-garde performance art, creating mechanical shifts of vocal production and character, like an ice pick through the skull. Her work has been described as mercurial by I Care If You Listen and dynamic by critic Steve Smith. She has received awards from the Concert Artist Guild, St. Bartolo Club Foundation, the John Cage Orgel Stiftung in Albertstadt, Germany, and the Puffin Foundation. Stephanie devours mammoth works of virtuosity and extended techniques with ease and creative insight, singing with an entire spectrum of vocal colors, including operatic style, straight tone, sputters, and throat noises, and performing in the classical, jazz, avant-garde, and interdisciplinary fields. She has performed as a soloist at Roulette Intermedium, Constellation Chicago, National Sawdust, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and the ReSound Festival in Cleveland, Ohio. Stephanie was a featured TEDx speaker for TEDx Waltham. On today's episode, we listen to Stephanie perform Adi Kamsuzu's Love's Witness.
In my practice, I work a lot with composers, especially in developing new works that are written for me. And what's really important for me at the beginning of the process is finding a way to meet in the middle, finding a way to collaborate and talk about our art as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. With a lot of composers, I, you know, schedule a separate meeting, you know, in person, Zoom, and we talk about kind of what we're looking for in the piece that we're developing together. Often that includes logistics, like the composer asking for range and, you know, comfy notes in my range or notes to avoid, things like that. Yeah. Depending on the composer's experience, sometimes I might talk a little bit about, you know, how to write for the voice,
sure.
Different like vowel modifications, things like that, and how to set text. Or if the composer is more experienced, I might just talk more about what's really comfortable for me, what's not comfortable for me, the plethora of techniques that I use, whether it's classical singing or different timbral techniques and glottal techniques and whatnot. I try to encourage the composer I'm working with, not necessarily to, you know, only use the most extreme techniques possible, but yeah, to know that, and, you know, mostly anything's on the table technique wise, right. And you know, whatever is most expressive to their artistic needs with this work, you know, I'm available to try, yeah, and to workshop. I don't want composers to think that, like, you know, to write new vocal music, it has to be filled with crazy techniques. Like, right, that's not the case. And often a lot of expressive music, new music is tonal, it's sure, lyrical. But I think, kind of having everything on the table and picking and choosing what kind of sounds fit text or lack of text, you know, what sounds fit the piece is a really important thing to kind of have from the get-go.
Where is that sweet spot between sort of direction for you and sort of interpretation?
I am very comfortable with improvisation, whether it's free improv or structural improv, and interpreting as much as I can, that's fine. Sometimes in different contexts, it's a little strange. Like if a composer, you know, is like, I've written this piece, it is a composed piece. And then it's like, improvise based on the stars for like 30 minutes. And it's like, well,
you're like, I could do that in my free time. Like, yeah.
well, I mean, it's still like a remarkable piece of art,
yes,
you know, but
yes,
it's yeah, more of a, if it's a structured improvisation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in those kind of times, I definitely like to meet with the composer and be like, well, are there kinds of sounds that you're looking for? Whether it's like, I don't know, more like vocalized sounds or percussive, like, kind of sounds. I like to make sure I kind of am in the ballpark so that if I'm just like improvising, you know, based on an image or something, it's not something completely different from what the composer was expecting. Unless sometimes the composer, you know, likes to be surprised.
Right.
And that's part of their creative process.
Yeah.
That's also great to know too.
What happens next then in the sort of creative performance process? Are you normally given drafts after that? Do you like to workshop with composers? Or is it after sort of establishing the expectations, it's like, all right, let's see the piece and make some refinements?
I like to work with a draft or two. It depends on the timeline.
Sure.
And also what the composer is getting out of the experience. Mm-hmm. Like if the composer is learning how to write for voice in this process, I like to give a lot of time for that and a lot of drafts and, you know, give space for that. If it's more of a transactional thing or it's like, I need to perform this in a couple of weeks, you know, I might work with like one draft, a couple corrections, be like, here we go.
Yeah, yeah.
See you on the other side.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, I definitely like to work with a draft or two in general, because sometimes, especially when it comes to like pitch range or like text setting, something on the page might feel different than like actually hearing like, you know, words that are like on a high C or something. And then the composer might be like, oh, maybe that's not really the feeling I was going for, yeah, you know, here. Or like, oh, actually, maybe if I drop that an octave, or like, if I, you know, they might make minor adjustments that fit their emotional drive in the piece. And especially with a voice, that's important.
So something I ask composers quite a bit is, when is a piece done? And so I'd love to pose the same question to you. Have you performed a piece and after performing it said, this piece is done? Have you ever said the opposite, saying like, well, you know, this piece needs more work?
Oh God, most of the time I feel like a piece is never done.
Right, right. Well, people struggle with that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess part of it is, yeah, not being able to let go and being like, you know, I could do this better or whatnot. And I think another aspect of that as a vocalist is that, you know, the voice changes,
yeah,
like throughout like years.
And the time of day,
you know,
and the weather. And yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Like, and depending on how my voice has developed, especially like in the past few years, for example, my middle range is like finally arrived. And to explain, like as a coloratura,
yeah,
when I was younger, it was my high notes were great, my low notes were great, and the middle was like kind of fuzzy.
Sure.
And so the way I interpreted music lended itself to those strengths, and I just, you know, learned how to use my voice in that way. And nowadays, going back to that same rep, now that I have these like juicy middle notes, mm-hmm, I'm like, I want to use those.
Right.
And I might want to express different words in a way to like land on those notes differently. And I'm sure that my voice is going to keep morphing and changing throughout the years. So that's a really exciting thing to be able to interpret through that. You know, I'll be able to visit a piece again and again, and it'll just feel different in my voice. I might also have different life experiences that might help me interpret a text in a certain way or something.
But when is it done? Is it done? Is it ever done? I've had some people say it's done when you leave it or something. It's done when it's performed. Mm-hmm. Some people like it's never done.
Not thinking in long term, mm-hmm, I suppose when I finish a concert or something, yeah, after the performance, I'm like, yeah, I'm putting this away,
yeah,
for a bit.
Yeah.
It's nice to kind of have a clean break.
Sure.
Especially because my performance schedule is usually pretty tight. I try to schedule as much as I can because it's hard for me to relax.
Well, different podcast. That's a whole different.
because of that, I have like an Excel spreadsheet of like when I'm doing what rep, and mm-hmm, just to be able to know when I can put something away and take on something new, that those boundaries are really important to me. Even if I pick up a piece later, it's good to know like this is done for now.
Yeah. I think people dread deadlines. I think people do. I think they dread them. But for me, I feel like they save my life. And that mm-hmm, sounds a little corny, but I think I would never get anything done if it wasn't for deadlines.
I think of that especially like when it comes to recording,
yeah,
especially because recording can be such a such a dramatic thing. Yeah. Like when I was recording my album this summer, I only gave myself a certain amount of sessions to do it, only two takes and then emergency corrections. Right. And it helps me. And you know, my recordings don't end up being perfect. A lot of my recordings have like a hiccup here and there, but I'm sort of proud of that. And also, like, if I were to try to be a perfectionist, I would still be in the recording studio right now.
Yeah, yeah. It's still the record button's still going. It's like hour 800. Yeah, take 315. Yeah.
Yeah.
But be.
Addy is a grad student at the University of California at Davis.
Fantastic.
And last year I was the artist in residence there for the graduate composition department.
Great.
Addy wanted to explore different extended techniques, kind of like in a Kate Soper fashion.
Sure.
And what was really cool about this piece is that she used these techniques in contrast to the text, which is a 17th century poem by a poet named Catherine Phillips. Mm-hmm. And so this contrast was really interesting to me. And I thought she did a fantastic job setting the text, really bringing out the drama and bringing out the curiosity of the voice without really straying too far from the meaning of the text.
When I look at the form of the piece, I see it sort of moving from the mechanics of sort of speech and text and voice, and then moving into sort of a specific set of pitches. And there's that wonderful expanding sort of upward melody line. There's a melody. How did you, though, I'd be interested as the performer and the interpreter, how did you interpret this form?
We looked a lot at the form of the poem. Mm-hmm. So it's in the two big old stanzas.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes with pieces that have a lot of different kind of sounds, especially like at the beginning of this piece.
Sure.
Sometimes it's easy to kind of like get lost in that and kind of forget the overall arc of the work. But yeah, we talked about text a lot. And in looking at these sounds as a performer, first I practiced the sounds just to make sure I can like do them. But also what's really important to me is how those particular sounds express the meaning behind the text, how like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe percussive, like have this maybe yeah. intention of like anxiety or like,
right.
like first love or like
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
And that's really important for me to find that continuity with sounds that might be just like popping out of nowhere.
Right. So what is the text and what is the meaning of the text? You said it was a 17th century poem?
Yeah, 17th century poem, and it's a love poem.
Right. Right.
It's about moments of love and romance being fleeting, but billets doux, meaning, yeah. you know, love letters.
Yeah.
Those are at least like a permanent tactile thing that you can look at. This like it's like a keepsake, you know.
Yeah.
You can look at it and kind of like bring yourself back to moments, to memories of love and whatnot.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like you mentioned before, where these sort of extended techniques or the sort of more technical things that you're doing with your voice can create this kind of non sequitur type thing for a listener. So like they can get very focused on those like little kind of interesting, like what is she doing with her voice? I mean, at one point you are singing inward, so you're breathing in and creating a tone, which is really exciting. But but yeah, there's those very sort of ephemeral things that happen. And then, you know, kind of like you're saying, the sort of melody ekes in and...
Yeah, but it's also good word painting because that one time that melody comes in
yes.
is on the word billet doux, and it's on the one tactile thing that's being mentioned
Absolutely.
In the poem. Then all the other extended techniques are like these fleeting memories that sort of like kind of like go by you. So I think it's extremely well done text painting on Addy's part.
Be
As a singer trained in, you know, classical American conservatory,
sure.
There's quite a bit of what's, you know, what I call like decolonization of the voice.
Yeah.
In schools, you know, vocalists are taught like, you know, we must sing in this bel canto technique or else we're not going to be successful classical singers. And I struggled with that in school because my voice has a lot of different colors to it, but sure. It didn't really lend itself to like the classical operatic style or career.
Yeah.
And I felt like a bad singer for a long time. So now, you know, through growth and just a lot of a lot of thinking about like my life as an artist and whatnot, I finally have embraced what my voice sounds like in the past few years, and I'm happy with it, and I'm able to be playful with my voice.
Yeah.
And so in that way, you know, I finally have developed, you know, my own tools, my own vocal facets, my natural vocal facets. Yeah. And they are extremely important to me because they are mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've leaned into them as strengths.
Well, you know, and even from a composer perspective too, like the idea that I have to be writing string quartets or I have to use these certain tools, I have to be notating everything and my scores have to be pieces of art within themselves, you know, all these things that we learn in conservatory training. And you're right. I think that imposter syndrome can seep in when you're like, I'm not doing it exactly the way my teachers did, or the people, even the people that I admire or look up to, I'm not doing it the way they did. So maybe therefore it's less.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're fortunate in that nowadays, like there are so many ways to have a career in music.
Mm-hmm.
There are standard ways of like playing with orchestras playing concertos or whatever. But I think now in new music, like, you know, we can produce and record music at home. We could teach, we could put on concerts. Like I think if I were born like, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, I wouldn't be able to just like fly around and be like, I'm doing like my own show. Like I'd be like the Florence Foster Jenkins.
Well, there's like a lot of great singers, you know, like Joan LaBarbara and Meredith Monk and a lot of these performers, composers that have they were just like, no, we're just not going to wait around in the wings for our 3-minute aria to be performed. We're just going to go out and make our own fortune. And, so I think, I think we owe a lot to them. So speaking of going out, doing it on your own, one might call that hard work. You took a look at 2.1, Creative Cogitation 2.1. Do you believe in talent or hard work?
I believe in a balance of it. I think there are times, depending on repertoire, whatnot, that, you know, you need to just log in the hours in the practice room and like,
sure.
you know, learn this phrase, learn these notes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even about like, you know, being the hardest worker, but it's just like knowing a piece of music, being like, I know myself, I need extra time to put this together and or it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, because, you know, we're all such different musicians with different strengths and weaknesses, I think it's good to acknowledge what one's strengths and weaknesses are. I think about that with repertoire. And if there's a section of a piece of music where I feel like, oh, this is not coming out well or something, sometimes it could be fixed in the practice room, but sometimes it could be like, this is just not in a great part of my range. I need to be okay with that, you know, and I need to just like get through it and work more or cultivate more parts of this piece that show off better parts of my voice, you know, and kind of put my expressivity in those sections. Yeah. And I think it saves a lot of time. It saves a lot of grief.
But I love this idea of also having some compassion for yourself and saying there's some things that either A, I'm not good at, or right now I'm not achieving this. So I can work hard on it, but at some point then I have to kind of say, I just have to be, have some compassion for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Last year I was working on a Kurt Tog's Kafka Fragments, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of places like that in the piece for me.
Yeah.
The piece is, I feel like the piece is written for like three different voice types.
Sure.
And there are just some sections that were, yeah. But there are just some sections that were just like, yeah. hard. They were difficult.
Absolutely.
I was like, oh God. Yeah, And what helped me most was just like putting those sections away mm-hmm. and like coming back to them later and mm-hmm. kind of like almost giving myself less time for those sections, which is weird. But in giving myself less time, then it was like, well, I know it's not going to be perfect. So I can just kind of be expressive and just kind of, you know, go on that feel. And that feeling of like, you know, not trying to be perfect and just like expressing, sometimes that produced a better sound than if I were to go in the practice room and be like, you know, you know, like
over
working, like,
and over
every day.
And over. Yeah. Until you just will it to like, you wake up in your sleep singing the part or performing the part. Yeah. Well, Stephanie, this has been fantastic. Before I let you go, could you tell us a little bit more about where we could find out more information about you and about the upcoming album that you have?
Sure. So I have a general artist website, www.stephanielamprea.com, that has, you know, a plethora of recordings in all different vocal styles and information about me and my contact information and my current projects. My upcoming current project is an album that I'm recording called Quaking Aspen. It's going to be released by New Focus Recordings on January 7, 2022. And it consists of six new works for a solo voice and some solo plus electronics. The composers featured are Jason Eckert, Wang Lu, Kurt Rohde, Hannah Celine, George Stanopoulos, and James May. Throughout the flow of the album, there are going to be recitations of the poems that are set. And the recitations are recited by me and my partner, William Bond. And then all the musical performances are by me. So it's a really, really exciting way to be able to hear poetry, both spoken and set through music. And all of the poems are by female poets, and all of the poems are about nature.
Thanks to Stephanie Lamprea for sharing her time and her performance with us. If you enjoyed this episode, please check out other episodes in the series. And as always, like, subscribe, or leave a comment on your preferred podcasting app. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and this has been The Process.